Okay, so now we can look at the end of this part. Time goes all the way to the end there. And this is kind of the most, in some ways, the most exciting thing here. Perhaps not the most practical part of it, because it's often the sort of thing that you have to look forward to, and where this is all ending up and where it all goes. And it's also nice to be aware of course, have some insight into that here. But before we do that, I want to finish off the mindfulness of breathing. So we had a look at the first two parts of that so far, which are equivalent to the first two parts of the Satipatthana Sutta. And now we're going to have to look at the two parts that are equivalent to the last two parts of the Satipatthana Sutta. So we had a look at how mindfulness of breathing, first you calm down the breath. And then when the breath calms down, you start to experience rapture and you have all these pleasurable feelings. And then you calm down that mental state that you have as well. Calm down the rapture, calm down whatever movement there is left in that mental state that you have at that point. And then when that mental state calms down, then this third aspect comes. And this is equivalent to the citta nipassana in the Satipatthana Sutta. Citta nipassana means contemplation of mind or contemplation of mindsets. So this is what we're coming to now. And this is what it sounds like in the Anapanasati Sutta. He trains, thus I shall breathe in, experiencing the mind. He trains thus, I shall breathe out, experiencing the mind. He trains thus, I shall breathe in, gladdening the mind. He trains thus, I shall breathe out, gladdening the mind. He trains thus, I shall breathe in, stilling the mind. He trains thus, I shall breathe out, stilling the mind. He trains thus, I shall breathe in, liberating the mind. He trains thus, I shall breathe out, liberating the mind. So here it's all about mind, so it kind of makes sense that it's part of the citta nipassana, contemplation of mind. And the first part here is experiencing the mind, which is interesting. What does that mean, experiencing the mind? And because we experience the mind all the time in one way. And of course the idea here is that the real experience of the mind happens when all the other things that are always there, always present, when they fade away and the mind is left on its own, that's when you really experience the mind. So what is happening here is that you're moving towards a point where the senses and the body and all of that fades away. And when all of that has faded away, then of course what you are left with is a mental experience. And I think the most natural way of understanding this here is that basically when you're kind of moving towards the nimitta, the kind of this, what is often called the samadhi nimitta, in Buddhism, in the suttas, not actually called that in the suttas, it is called the vision of light or something to that effect. Or vasa, it is called, if you go to the Upakilesa Sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya. But I think this is roughly moving into that area now. When you start to see kind of light in the meditation, very often very powerful, beautiful light that arrives with lots of happiness that comes together with these things. And this is when the mind becomes distilled, in a sense, it becomes separated from the senses and from the physical phenomena of the world. So now we're getting very, very deep into meditation at this point. Now we're doing the last little things, right here, the last little things to kind of move the mind towards the real samadhi of the jhanas and these kind of things. We're in that very last bit of the path, taking us all the way to the absolute stillness of the jhana state. So first of all, you experience that mind, possibly, quite likely, here talking about nimitta experiences. Then you gladden that nimitta, And the gladdening just means brightening it up, making it even more beautiful, even more pittisukha, even more peaceful, all these kind of things. And remember that what we're talking about here, when it says gladdening the mind, there's nothing you do. You just sit back, you watch, you are aware, and the less you do, the more you kind of allow that experience to unfold, this gladdening process, it happens by itself. This is kind of the point here. It's a self-happening process, nothing you need to do at all, it's just kind of automatic. You just sit back and watch it all unfold, it's kind of the beauty of this. And then stilling the mind, so the idea here, there might still be some degree, little bit of movement there perhaps left, a tiny little bit of movement, maybe the nimitta is moving a little bit, or you don't feel maybe not 100% absolutely still. you feel really, really still already compared to normal, but, you know, still there's a little bit left there perhaps. So you keep on focusing, allowing everything to fall away here. And as all the restlessness falls away, all of these other things fall away, things become more still, more happy here. And it's like you're moving towards something really, you feel really kind of, you have to be careful, it's easy to get excited, right? Because this is kind of really out there, it's really, it's really, whoa, what's going on here? So you allow this to happen, you don't really know where this is going yet. Yeah, you're not really sure what's going to happen here. Until suddenly kind of things go bang. Yeah. And this is kind of the idea of a jhana experience, that it's almost like you kind of enter into a separate realm in a sense. There comes a point, and this is the idea of liberating the mind. Yeah, there comes a point when you give up the five senses completely, absolutely. Yeah. And you, at that point, when you have given them up completely, yeah, you don't have any access to them anymore. You can't choose to see, you can't choose to hear, you can't choose to feel. Have gone beyond that access to the five senses. And this is why it can seem scary, because all of these things that we are so used to in the ordinary world, all of these things that we attach to, usually to a fairly high degree, suddenly can't even access them anymore. And this is what we mean by real giving up and real renunciation, when these things are completely out of reach. And that's why there is a kind of a shift in the mind at this particular point, a kind of a big shift in the feeling that something is really, you know, a major thing has happened when you move into the dharma states. It's like the moving from kamaloka. Kamaloka is the world of sensuality or of the senses. You move from that world into the world of the what is called the rupaloka in the suttas, which is the world of form. Basically, it is equivalent to the dharma states. This shift happening. You get liberated. Liberated from the five senses, liberated from the body, liberated from the five hindrances. For the first time, the five hindrances are completely absent, completely gone. There's nothing left. The mind is absolutely pure at this particular point. So this is the idea of liberation here. Yeah, the entry into these profound states of samadhi. And this, and you know, it's said that elsewhere that this is kind of moving in. It's like entering a different realm in a sense. It's kind of strange territory, beautiful territory, but very different from what we are, what we're used to here. And it is on this basis then, through that liberation of the mind, it is on that basis coming next year that the contemplation of impermanence, the contemplation, the insights and all these things happen, they come based on this particular, on that whole process leading to this particular point. So that's where we come to the fourth part here. And this is where we're talking about insight. This is when getting close to the last of the four aspects of the Satipatthana Sutta, the contemplation of Dhammas. Dhammas here being principles or kind of the understanding of the conditionality and all of this. So then after a while you emerge from that samadhi, yeah, and then you kind of look back and you think, wow. And then you kind of start understanding things in this way. Yeah. So this is what the last part here says. He trains thus, I shall breathe in, contemplating impermanence, anicca. He trains thus, I shall breathe out, contemplating impermanence. He trains thus, I shall breathe in, contemplating fading away. He trains thus, I shall breathe out, contemplating fading away. He trains thus, I shall breathe in, contemplating cessation. He trains thus, I shall breathe out, contemplating cessation. He trains thus, I shall breathe in, contemplating relinquishment. He trains thus, I shall breathe out, contemplating relinquishment. So here, this is the insight part, where you try to kind of see things clearly here. And the question here, well, how exactly do you do this? You contemplate impermanence. What exactly do you contemplate? And of course, what you contemplate here, the obvious thing, is you're just going through this whole process of mindfulness of breathing beforehand, and within that process, all of these things have been happening here. There's been impermanence going on, there's been fading away going on, there's been cessation going on here. So what you do, the most obvious thing to look at here, is look back upon that process that has been happening here, and use that as the raw material for the insight contemplation here. So this is what is going on here. So if you look at that process, first of all, there is an impermanence there. Things are always changing. In this context, impermanence just means things are changeable, right? things coming and going is what it means in this particular context. So throughout this whole process, things are obviously changing all the time. Also, of course, they are fading away. Yeah. So you have the fading away gradually of the body, of the five senses, the breath gradually becoming more refined. You have certain feelings and perception fading away. All painful feelings fade pretty much first of all, until you're left with only happy feelings. Then those happy feelings become more refined. The coarser aspect of those fade away. The will fades away. This is an important part of this. As you go through this process, the mind becomes more and more still. And because of that, the willpower, the whole doing, the agency inside of you is fading away. These can issue in really profound insights. You know, when you see that the very agent inside of you is impermanent and fading away, that's a very powerful thing to be able to see that. And then with the fading away, the gradual reduction in these things, there comes a point when those things cease completely, they come to a complete end, this absolute stop. And that is, again, all the same phenomena, right, coming to a complete end. And that is where, of course, the really powerful insight can be had, because that is impermanence in a very deep and very profound sense. This word anicca can mean many different things. It can mean impermanence in a fairly ordinary sense, but it can also mean impermanence in this profound sense of cessation, things ending completely and no longer being accessible to you. Yeah, and then when you see that something has completely ceased, you actually gain a lot of insight. What you see there is that, first of all, you see that it's completely unreliable. It's, you know, it's not something that it always has to be there. Second thing you understand is that it's dukkha. You understand that because when it ceases, things are much better. Yeah, body is gone, five senses are gone. Actually, it is far preferable. The will is gone. The will that we identify with so much and we take to be so much essence of who we are. We are the doers in the world. We are the people who create things, the creators, all these things. Creative activity, right? Very, very intoxicating. Everybody likes to create something, at least on some level. And here you understand, actually, you're not really the creator. And when you give it up, you feel much better. Yeah, so very powerful insight into the idea of suffering and happiness, impermanence and non-impermanence. And finally, also what you see is non-self. These things that you have given up, that you kind of have gone out the door, they can't be a self, because now they're completely gone. You have, don't even have any access to them anymore. So for that reason, they can have nothing to do with the essence of who you are. These are just phenomena coming and going in the world. And suddenly they're gone, and you're still there, and it's perfectly okay. So it must be non-self. Yeah, so what we are seeing here, just based on this idea of going into a deep state of samadhi, you can actually have already very deep insight into nature, the nature of existence. And this is actually a very important point, because sometimes people think that there are two paths in Buddhism. There's the vipassana path on the one hand, and the samatha path on the other hand. You know, if you do vipassana, all you have is insight. If you do samatha, all you have is karma. I don't think anybody really believes quite that, you know, rigid distinction. But there is this kind of idea of a distinction between two different paths. But the point is that if you have one, you also have the other. If you have the other, you also have the one. Samatha and vipassana are two sides of the same coin. They can't be distinguished. When you become very peaceful like this, you are bound to see impermanence. You're bound to see things disappearing, are suffering and non-self. You can't avoid that. It is almost part and parcel of what happens. So this last part of the path here, once you have kind of been liberated through a jhana state or whatever, these things tend to happen as a, almost automatically because of that. So this is what is going on here. Then we have the last one. The last one is relinquishment, the fourth one. And relinquishment here seems to refer to the idea of giving up craving and attachment completely, more fully. So first of all, you see the cessation, you contemplate that, and when that inside contemplation of things ceasing, when that matures, there comes a point when you stop craving for those things, because you realize they are suffering, they are non-self. Craving no longer has a foothold, no longer has anything, any reason for its existence. Craving becomes kind of defunct. And so craving stops, attachment to these things stops as a consequence. That is what relinquishment means in Buddhism. Stopping the attachment. The thing may still be there, but your relationship to the thing has changed. A different type of relationship from now on. So this is what is going on here, roughly here. Do you have to do all the 12 steps to do the insight contemplation? And the answer is probably not. You can already get some insight the deeper your meditation goes. The deeper is the basis for having insight and wisdom on this sensor. So the more down, the further down you go, the better. But you don't have to go all the way before getting at least some insight in what is going on. But of course, when you go into a real state of samadhi and things disappear completely, it's very easy to see why that must be a very strong and powerful basis for insight, precisely because you have seen things that disappearing, vanishing, thin air, gone, no access, nothing there anymore. So that is what happens at the end of the Anapanasati Sutta. Yeah, and you can see how it's quite natural, how it all fits together quite beautifully here. There's nothing really magical about it. It's a natural thing that goes on as you do this. And quite exciting, right? Imagine going through this process. What you're experiencing is more and more bliss as you go through this, deeper and deeper in it. And I think Ajahn Brahm is one point of that. After a while, you think there's so much bliss on this path that you don't know if you can take all this bliss anymore. Yeah? There's too much bliss. And this is kind of what this path is about. And then on top of that, you get this life-shattering insights which change your entire outlook and then establishes that happiness on a more permanent and more kind of solid footing as well. The whole process is very beautiful and wonderful. The path is wonderful. The results are wonderful. Wonderful. Good in the beginning, good in the middle, good in the end, right? This is the Buddhist path there. So it's a pretty good deal. You can't really get better than this. Okay. So, the very end here. Because that is how mindfulness of breathing is developed and cultivated so that it is of great fruit and great benefit. And there's a very last little paragraph there, and that is just one of those things that shows that when we talk about the body, we mean many different things. And in this particular case, body means the breath body in that first passage we're talking about before there. Not need to worry too much about that. It's just a little thing to pass that by for now, I think. That is the Anapanasati Sutta, very beautiful and nice, takes us all the way to the jhanas already. So we're now on the cusp between Sammasati and Sammasamadhi, the seventh and the eighth factor of the Noble Eightfold Path. I want to have a look at one more sutta, quite briefly, which talks about this connection between Sammasati and Sammasamadhi, and how we move from one to the other one. We have looked at many of these things already, so it shouldn't take too long, hopefully. That's the theory. The reality, we'll see what happens. This is the Mahanama Sutra from the Anguttara Nikaya 6.10. And Mahanama was a cousin of the Buddha from the Sakyan clan. And he was supposed to be a stream enter. So he was a lay person who was stream enter, right? So it shows that these things can be done by both lay people and monastics. This is how it goes. On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling among the Sakyans at Kapilavatthu, a companion tree park. Then Mahanama the Sakyan approached the Blessed One, paid homage to him, sat down to one side, and said to the Blessed One, Bhante, how does a noble disciple who has arrived at the fruit and understood the teaching often dwell? So this actually says that he is an Aryan, arrived at the fruit, means that he is a noble person already. That's what it basically saying there. And this is what the Buddha replies. And by the way, it doesn't mean that this is only applicable to people who already are stream members. It's applicable to everyone, because this kind of instruction you find for other people elsewhere here. And this is what the Buddha says, how you should dwell if you are a stream member. Also try to dwell if you are not a stream member here. Here, Mahanama, a noble disciple, recollects the Tathagata thus. The Blessed One is an Arahant, perfectly enlightened, accomplished in true knowledge and insight and conduct, fortunate, knower of the world, unsurpassed trainer of tameable people, teacher of gods and humans, the awakened one, the Blessed One. And we have seen this already. I've been talking about this like quite lot of length at the beginning of the retreat or the middle or whatever it was. And so you can go back to that. So based on that reflection, right? This is why these reflections are so powerful. Based on that reflection, this is what happens. So when a noble disciple recollects the Tathagata, the Buddha, on that occasion his mind is not obsessed by greed or by desire, ill will, and confusion. On that occasion his mind is simply straight, based on the Tathagata. A noble disciple whose mind is straight gains inspiration in the meaning, gains inspiration in the Dhamma, gains joy connected with the Dhamma. When he is joyful, rapture arises. For one with a rapturous mind, the body becomes tranquil. One tranquil in body feels pleasure. For one feeling pleasure, the mind becomes stilled. Yeah, you recognize these things again and again. The same idea is popping up in slightly different contexts. And we kind of make that jigsaw puzzle complete with all the different pieces kind of falling into place as you see these things. This is called the noble disciple who dwells in balance amid an unbalanced population, who dwells unafflicted amid an afflicted population. As one who has entered the stream of the Dhamma, he develops recollection of the Buddha. So, when you remember the Buddha in the right way, what you do is that you remember what really matters in life. You remember the path, you remember the highest outcome of that path, you remember all the qualities, that wonderful thing of having this teacher, right? This teacher who has penetrated to the truth of the mind and what existence is all about. And what an astonishing thing it is to be able to have a teacher like that. And because you understand that Dhamma, you understand where happiness lies and where to direct your mind, at that time you don't have any sensual desire, any ill will or any confusion. The mind is simply straight. The idea of a straight mind is precisely the mind which is not crooked by all the defilements. And then, when your mind is straight, because you're thinking about the Buddha, you get inspired in the meaning. The meaning is like the goal again, the goal of the path. You understand what the goal is. You understand the idea of where real happiness lies, yeah, and where the end of suffering is. Pali here is Atta Veda. And this word Veda in Pali has this double meaning of Veda in the sense of like almost like Vedana in the sense of feeling on the one hand, and Veda in the sense of Vidya, with Te Vidya, the three insights, the three higher knowledges, and also three insights. This is also Veda, so it has this mixture of insight on the one hand, and emotion on the other hand, feeling on the other hand. So very similar to inspiration in English, right? When inspiration is you feel inspired, it's a feeling, but it's also like something which is driven by understanding usually. So these things coming together. The Pali word actually behind this, which is Veda, is actually related to, I think the German word is Wissen. Wissen, right? To know, yeah. And it's also related to the English word wit, which is quite nice. In English, the word wit has both the understanding of like wit being intelligent in the sense of ready wit. Ready wit is like being intelligent and sharp. But wit also means like fun, right? It's also kind of like a feeling side of things. So it is one of these Indo-European words that exists across all the Indo-European languages pretty much, wherever you go. Still the meaning is very much preserved across those various languages. So you gain this inspiration in the meaning. You understand the matter goal, yeah? And of course, inspiration in the Dhamma, because you have these teachings that are there, and they deliver you, they help you to actually go and move towards that goal. Yeah, this is what that inspiration is all about. And you think, whoa! And then again, from that, then the joy arises. And the joy here is the pamuja. Again, the joy comes from all of this, because of that inspiration. And then, from that joy, the whole sequence takes off. All of these factors come into existence as a consequence of this. All the factors we saw before, what I call the psychology of meditation, and all of that. Joy comes rapture, piti, from piti comes tranquility, which is pasadi, from pasadi comes sukha, which is happiness, and then from that comes the samadhi. Your mind gets drawn into the object because you're just so happy with what is going on. So here we're using the contemplation of the idea of what the Buddha is all about. To give you that foundation of the path. And you can do this in many different ways. Yeah, but often with all kinds of meditation practice, it's always good to sit down for a while, first of all, just to feel calm and peaceful and allow some degree of mindfulness to arise. Regardless of what you're going to do, that's always a good idea. And then you can proceed in different ways. You can go straight to the breath. You can, if you find that these contemplations work for you, can do some of these contemplations, whatever it is. And then you can somehow mix these with the breath. But if you feel really happy, you can go on to the breath later on and kind of allow the breath to take you even further in. Or you can do the breath for a while to feel peaceful. And if you don't get anywhere, you don't get any joy, you can do some of these contemplations later on to aid you with that joy. None of these things give joy very easily. You have to really kind of, you have to reflect on these things a little bit. But this is the idea. This is kind of what is happening here. So these things kind of come together in different ways and then give rise to these feelings. And then you live balanced amid an unbalanced population. Your mind is kind of even, right? You're not being kind of pushed around by the defilements, jumping up and down all the time. And you live unafflicted because the defilements are an affliction. They cause suffering all the time. And as one who has entered the stream of the Dhamma, this is, means someone who is a stream enterer, you develop recollection of the Buddha. So that is the basic idea. That basic idea is then repeated in different ways of developing this basic idea. Let's have a quick look at those various ways. So the second one is the recollection of the Dhamma, which we also have seen before very briefly. We saw that in the Samvitti Sutta. And this is always in the same way. This is the Dhamma is well expounded by the Blessed One, directly visible, immediate, inviting one to come and see, applicable to be personally experienced by the wise. So this is how you think about the Dhamma according to the Buddha. Directly visible, sanditika, immediate, akalika. These are synonyms in this particular context. And they mean two things. First of all, they mean that the Dhamma is something you can achieve in this very life. Sanditika is always opposed to samparayika in the sutta. Samparayika means that which relates to future lives. So you can experience the Dhamma all the way to the end in this very life. And this, of course, is one of the things that sets the Buddhist teaching sometimes apart from other teachings. But also, as I was explaining the other day, that we saw in the Samvitti Sutta, is the idea that you can actually experience the things, the benefit of the Dhamma in this very moment, right? If you turn your mind in the right direction right now, if you turn your mind toward generosity in this moment, you will feel immediate results from that. And that happiness and that immediate result you get from that is this present moment happiness that draws your mind into the present moment, and which is devoid of the ordinary craving and desire that comes with the happiness of sense pleasures. It's a different type of happiness, and that can be experienced right here and right now. So it's a powerful teaching. All you really have to do is to use yonisomanasikara in the right way. And if you do that, that you can get access to that stilling of the mind, the increase in mindfulness, even the joy, straight away, if you have that ability. This is the power, what he's basically saying here. So it's actually a very important, a very nice quality of the Dhamma. Inviting you to come and see is more of the same. Yeah, just come, check it out, and kind of enjoy yourself. That's what it's saying. And applicable here means that it means something like it is worthy of application. Upanayaka is the Pali word. In other words, it is worthy of being applied. Why? Because this is something which actually gives results. So it's actually worthy of application. And to be personally experienced by the wise. I don't know if you think you're wise or not, but the problem is that wisdom is something that gets developed. So we all have some degree of wisdom. Otherwise you wouldn't be here, right? If you hadn't had some degree of wisdom. So we all have some degree of wisdom. And so we develop that. Wisdom just happens as you develop this path. You don't have to worry too much about how wise you are. You just develop this as you go along. And it happens as a consequence. And then, what happens? Same thing happens again, right? All the hindrances are abandoned because now you know where real happiness is to be found, where suffering is to be found. Your mind is straight again. Because the mind is straight, you feel inspired. You understand the meaning of all of this. You're inspired by the fact that you have this teaching. The Dhamma is available. Dhamma always refers to the teaching, the doctrine of these things. And as you do, that joy arises, and this whole sequence comes into effect again. Joy, rapture, tranquility, pleasure, and then stillness of the mind. And then you are one of these unafflicted people who has a balanced mind among a population which is unbalanced and afflicted. Then we have the contemplation of the Sangha. This refers to the noble Sangha, the Aryan Sangha, and it goes as follows. The Sangha of the Blessed One's disciple is practicing the good way, Supatipanno, practicing the straight way, Ujjupatipanno, practicing the true way, Nyayapatipanno, practicing the proper way, Sammicipatipanno. That is the four pairs of persons, the eight types of individuals. This Sangha of the Blessed One's disciple is worthy of gifts, worthy of hospitality, worthy of offerings, worthy of reverential salutation, the unsurpassed field of merit for the world. So that is the Sangha. And the idea here, all of these things about practicing the straight way and true way and all of this, it is all about the fact that once you become a noble disciple, the path is part of you. It's part of your psychology. It's kind of built into your mind. That's why you're practicing the straight way. You can't really go backwards anymore. You don't kind of go on a windy route, you go on a straight route. And what that means, that for everyone else, right, it means that if you're not an alien yet, it means that your route tends to get a bit windy, because sometimes you know what you're doing, sometimes you don't. So you have a general kind of tendency in moving in the right direction, but sometimes we lose the path a little bit. Then we come back on it, and we try our very best to kind of head in the right direction. This is a distinction here between the noble ones and everyone else. So keep that in mind. So our job then is to maximize kind of going straight towards the goal and trying to avoid too many kind of, blind alleys and cul-de-sacs and don't go anywhere, and kind of get you on that path that actually goes to the goal. So then we had this idea of the four pairs and eight types of individuals, which I'm not going to go into that, but that is basically the noble disciples categorized differently. It's not that interesting, so we can leave that out for now. And these noble disciples are worthy of gifts, worthy of hospitality, worthy of offerings, worthy of reverential salutation. The idea is that there are certain things in the world worthy of respect. And of course, if somebody has the ability to teach you the way to the highest happiness, then that is kind of those people are, in a sense, the highest kind of teachers. Yeah, the teacher always gives you something of value. These teachers give you the highest value. And that is why you have this, that they are worthy of these things. That is kind of the idea there. And they are the unsurpassed field of merit for the world. When you kind of support the highest, then you also tend to feel the highest happiness back again. Because you have this feeling that you're supporting something really worthwhile. And they tend to feel really happy about that you are supporting that. They support you, you support them. It's this kind of beautiful circle of mutual support where everybody supports each other. So that is the idea of the Sangha. So it's great to know that there are people in the world who still practice this path, who still gain these results, right? If the world was without noble ones, and all you had was paper, and you had people reading sutras and that kind of thing, it wouldn't be the same. The fact that there are people who do these things, who get these results, is actually really inspiring and very worthwhile. And you see kind of the results of these things in front of your own eyes. There are some remarkable examples. One of the things that I like to do sometimes is to think of some of these people and how they act, what they are like. Because you realize that the way some of these people live is not really possible unless you have some special meditative insight or some special samadhi power at the very least. You can't really do it. And one of the, some of these monks, to give an example, there's one well-known monk in Sri Lanka. He is originally, I think he's kind of Danish-French, half Danish, half French, something like that. He's obviously a Western monk, but he is one of these monks who lives in the jungle all the time. And in the jungle, he has three kutis they have, the huts they have in the jungle. I only have three walls. Yeah, why do they only have three walls? Because it says it wants this creature to be like a cave. If it's like, so it's like a cave, so it has more of that kind of real forest feel to it. So it's completely open on one side and has three walls. So what happens is that sometimes, you know, when you wake up in the morning, you have like a wild animal sleeping next to you. Yeah, so you have like a snake lying there. Oh yeah, good morning, snake. This is actually what happens, right? This is actually what it's like. Yeah. And then so he stays like that, and he stays in these cuties. And then once a day he walks into the village for alms, and he kind of meets the villagers, and the villagers offer him alms. Maybe he gives them a simple teaching or a blessing or something like that. And then he goes back again into the jungle. That is all the contact he has with people, right, during the day. And then once a year he comes out of the jungle, and he kind of meets with other monks and has Dhamma discussions, talking about Nibbana, talking about insight, talking about all these profound things. And after kind of a few days of discussion with the other monks, he kind of disappears back into the jungle again. Right? It's really almost like straight out of some of these arahants in the suttas. Yeah? It's really kind of quite astonishing. And he has lived like that for the past 35 years, apparently, or something like that. And I don't know how easy it is to live with after that. It may be very hard to live with a person like that who's kind of lived in the jungle all the time. Right? But so this is the kind of thing. And you know, how can you actually live like that? Very, very simple life. If you went to his cutie, there's hardly anything there. It's almost completely empty. There's nothing inside it. You see a picture. We have a picture of him at our monastery, actually. He doesn't know about this because if he had known, he wouldn't have approved it, right? No pictures. But he has got kind of this white hair and kind of white beard. He looks like something completely out of the jungle, basically. Not very short, kind of, really. And then, but you realize that somebody like that, the only way you can survive like that, year after year, decade after decade, living so simply, is because you have access to some kind of happiness, some kind of meaning, which is far more profound than the meaning people can find in ordinary life. That's what you realize, and it kind of inspires you that there's something more in this world. You can almost see it in front of your eyes, that there's something more in this world that is incredibly valuable, far more valuable than those things you ordinary value in life. And this is what is so powerful about this, when you see these kind of things, because you see something that you think almost shouldn't be possible. So these are the kind of people we're talking about. Another example is, you know, when Ajahn Brahm went on a 6-month retreat once. I don't know if you heard about this. He went on a 6-month retreat, and he didn't see anyone for 6 months. Nobody. Not a single person for 6 months. All he had was his little cutie, 7 square meters, a walking path outside, and he was given food every day, and then he would, in a certain box, and he would pick it up after the person had left. And when he came off that retreat, he could barely remember our names, right? Because they've been so peaceful for so long that he kind of let go of all that kind of stuff. So he was kind of very happy that he couldn't remember our names, because he said that was really kind of letting go of everything, right? Well, he could remember some of our names, but of course. And then he initially, it was very hard for him to speak, because his mind had been so still, he wasn't really able to get kind of the mind going again. Then his first talk after that retreat, after his mind kind of got going again after a few days, the name of the talk was 6 Months of Bliss. That was kind of the name of the talk. Yeah. So you know what he was doing for 6 months? He was just blissing out, just deep meditation all the time, until the mind becomes so still that the mind doesn't really want to start up again when you come out of that meditation. It's just, you know, so happy and so contented, doing absolutely nothing here. This is the kind of stuff, right, that really kind of is really inspiring. For most people, it would be a kind of horrible to be, like, you know, isolation for 6 months. It would be terrible. You go crazy. You go completely nuts, most people. But if you have the right foundation, actually, it is the highest bliss that you can experience. And there are a few stories like that. There are some nuns as well, actually. I should mention the nuns, because sometimes it tends to be a bit male-centric, which is unfortunate. There are some very inspiring nuns as well. There's one nun, Tenzin Palmo, a very famous English nun, who kind of spent a 3-year retreat in a cave in the Himalayas by herself. Yeah, which also is very, very inspiring. Yeah.
12 years.
12 years, wasn't it? 12 years. Okay, sorry. 12 years. Okay. Okay. Yeah. And she certainly wasn't crazy when she came out, because she was actually also very together when she came out. So also very, quite astonishing. 12 years. Oh, there you go. That's really it. really extraordinary there. And so there are many inspiring people like that. You have people like Aya Kema, of course. She's German, by the way. And she was also very inspiring in many ways, and she had some very good meditation experiences, obviously. And so there is on both sides of the... I'm talking mostly about Westerners now, because I know mostly about Westerners, but of course there are some Asian monks too who are very, very inspiring. I have already mentioned Adam Ganha before. There's a famous story. This is a Chinese monk. His name was Empty Cloud, right? It's kind of a nice name, Empty Cloud. A cloud is already empty. How can you be Empty Cloud? It's like empty emptiness or something like that. He was a Chinese monk. He lived in mainland China. And he was the master of another monk called Master Hua, who started a monastery in California, in the city of 10,000 Buddhas. Quite had some relationships with Adam Sumedho and also with us at Bodhinana Monastery here. And this Empty Cloud, he was, this is in his biography, his meditation was incredibly profound. And one day somebody offered him some food, right? So he said, I'm just going to go into meditation before I eat the food. And then he comes out 7 days later, and the food is moldy, right? And all that. So this kind of thing, these are kind of really, really astonishing stories. Anyway, I'm just giving you some idea of, you know, the Sangha and the Santi, that there are people out there who are really kind of extraordinary. And I'm sure that there are some lay people in the world as well who actually get really good meditation and who are very impressive in this way. It's not just the monastics. Sometimes, and it's important to bring that in as well. There's quite a well-known, for example, quite a well-known meditation teacher in the United States called Shaila Catherine. And she is very famous for the deep samadhi, etc., as a layperson. And she used to be part of the Paok meditation system. There's one right there. Anyway, we have to move on. So the same thing happens again. You reflect on the Sangha, and all of these things happen. You read samadhi on that basis, if you think about it in the right way. Then we have the recollection of virtue, of sila. And here we have the noble disciple recollects his own virtuous behavior as unbroken, flawless, unblemished, unblotched, freeing, praised by the wise, ungrasped, leading to stillness. This is how you think about your virtue, right? When you think back and you understand what is going on here. So first of all, the idea that it has to be very consistent, so it's unbroken, flawless, unblemished. You've been doing it in all these details, and you've been doing it for a long time. This is how these qualities arise. And it's freeing, right? It's liberating to practice virtue. Sometimes people think that practicing virtue is like imprisoning yourself because you have to follow rules. But it's only superficially imprisoning it. As far as mental qualities go, as far as the liberation of the mind goes, it's freeing it. It frees up your mind from defilements, and your mind, when the defilements are left, actually feels more free. I'm sure you all know what I'm talking about. When the mind becomes really free of these things, you actually feel a very powerful sense of inner freedom. So virtue, in the deeper sense, is freeing. It is not imprisoning at all. That is an important thing to grasp. Praise by the wise, yeah? So that's quite handy. It's better to be praised by the wise than be praised by the scallywags of the world. Yeah, ungrasped, and this is the idea that the higher your virtue is, the less you are grasping onto it, especially when you become a stream entry, there's no need to grasp anymore. It becomes naturally part of you. You become naturally virtuous. Prior to that, we have to hold on to virtue a little bit, otherwise we're going to keep on breaking our precepts all the time. But eventually you come to this point where it's ungrasped, and then leading to stillness. Yeah. And again, this idea, the profound connection between sila and meditation right there. And you see everywhere in the suttas, always kind of coming up, the idea that sila is really the most powerful source, the most important foundation for any kind of meditation practice. So that is it. So you know that. You know this about your conduct. You look back, and when you do that, exactly the same thing happens again. You feel good about yourself. Yeah, you're... Mind is no longer obsessed by all these defilements. It is straight, based on virtuous behavior, and all of these things happen until stillness again is arises as a consequence of all this. Then we have the last one. This is the recollection of generosity, and this is goes as follows: it is truly my good fortune I think we saw this before, but I'm not sure now. My fortune and gain, that the population, inner population obsessed by the stain of miserliness. I dwell at home with a mind devoid of the stain of miserliness. Freely generous, open-handed, delighting in relinquishment, devoted to charity, delighting in giving and sharing. This is the recollection of generosity. And this, of course, is taking generosity to a very high extent here again. This is the noble disciple, right? It's nice. Sometimes, you know, when you see other people who are stingy, you might kind of look down upon them and think, wow, these people, they don't, you know, how can they be so stingy? That's really bad to be so stingy, this kind of thing. But here, actually, you look at it in the other way. You think that, well, stinginess is often normal. People are stingy because they are attached to the things that they want to hold on to, you know, what feels like it's mine, I don't want to give it up. But here, you are actually rejoicing in the fact that you haven't got that stinginess. You are different. You have understood something more profound. You have understood something about the profound beauty of being generous. And you rejoice in the fact that you have eliminated that defilement that other people are obsessed by. Instead of judging others badly, you understand that those people, they are actually trapped by a negative mindset. They are trapped by something, and you have been released from that trap. Because of that, you rejoice in that instead. So it's kind of strange, isn't it, that generosity, I think, is often very much underappreciated in our society. But actually, generosity is a beautiful opening of the mind. And being stingy and being miserly is the opposite of that. It's a trap, it's a holding down, it's something which stops you, blocks you from a development of the path. So, freely generous, open-handed, delighting in relinquishment, right? Devoted to charity, delighting in giving and sharing, and kind of saying it from many, many different ways, what is going on here. And once again, I think I mentioned this before, but all of this is really required for samadhi to become possible. If you haven't got this kind of mindset, you can only go so far in your meditation. And then based on that, knowing that, thinking that, knowing the fact that your mind is like this, perhaps thinking of specific instances, but really here is more a kind of a total feeling of what the mind is like. Again, same kind of process as before, takes you all the way to stillness based on that. So, there you are. So these are all ways of giving rise to joy. And these are the famous anusattis, the famous recollections that we have on the Buddhist path. And all mentioned very often in the suttas, all of these things. And because they are mentioned often again, it means they are important, right? These things are actually things that are very useful for giving rise to joy in our meditation practice. And very often, The correct way of doing this, right? We have here the sila anusati, recollection of virtue or recollection of generosity. There's different ways of doing this, but the most important thing is not to use too much force in trying to remember something from the past. The ideal way is to do this so consistently and so thoroughly that when you sit down, it almost comes automatically. But you can also use your mind a little bit, especially if you have some recollection of times when you felt really happy about something, you can bring your mind back to that and bring that happiness into the present moment. That also works. It's a bit more limited, but it also works to some extent. And it can brighten up the present moment, get rid of all that cloudedness of the mind, the tiredness and all of those kind of things. And then, woof, off you go. Stillness, happiness, mindfulness, joy, all of those things coming through you now. Okay. So now we have to go back to the gradual training again. So now, please come back to Majjhima Nikaya 27. Actually, quite at the beginning. So we were looking at sense restraint, we were looking at clear awareness, we were looking at abandoning the five hindrances. Yeah. And then, once the five hindrances are abandoned, this is what happens. So now we have finally prepared the way for samadhi, right stillness on the path. Now we come finally to the last factor of the Noble Eightfold Path. You can see I have left 10 minutes for the last factor. Yeah? So out of 20 hours, 10 minutes goes for the last factor. And that is because the last factor is pretty much automatic. All the hard work is in the beginning of the path. So you focus on where the work is, And then now we're talking about the results. So this is why. So then the Buddha says, having thus abandoned these five hindrances, imperfections of the mind that weaken wisdom, quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome qualities, he enters upon and abides in the first jhana, which is accompanied by initial and sustained application of the mind with rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. This Brahmin is called the footprint of the Tathagata, something scraped by the Tathagata, something marked by the Tathagata. But the noble disciple does not yet come to the conclusion. The Blessed One is fully awakened. The Dhamma is well proclaimed by the Blessed One. The Sangha is practicing the good way. So here, first of all, now you have abandoned all those imperfections of the mind that weaken wisdom. This is kind of the point here. If you still have some imperfections, this is like upakilesa in Pali. This is roughly equivalent to the five hindrances. If you have any of that left, wisdom is going to be weakened. Wisdom is going to be sidetracked into the future, into the past, into all of these kinds of things. So they have to be, they have to go completely here. Then, quite secluded, it says here, from sensual pleasures. Viviceva kamehi. And here, kama is actually used in the plural sense. And in the plural sense, it refers to the five senses. So here, it would be more easy to understand if it was translated as fully secluded from the five senses, would be a preferable translation in this case, I think. Secluded from unwholesome qualities. Vibhicha akusalehi dhammehi. So this, again, any unwholesome qualities, basically, again, refers back to the five hindrances. You enter upon the first jhana. You enter this new world, this new place, so that you have never been, maybe you've probably been there before, but a long, long time ago, perhaps. And now you enter this kind of wonderful, amazing, astonishing place, which is, says here, accompanied by vitakka vichara. And this is two of these words that have, you know, are debated up and down in the, or in Buddhist circles. It seems to mean, and I think it must mean, at the very end here, vitakka vichara is a reference to the very final movement of the mind, as you abandon all movement of the mind in the second jhana. This is the most refined vitakka vichara that is possible in samsara, before it is completely abandoned in the second jhana. It makes sense that it should be extremely refined at this point, because in the next jhana it is completely gone. So that is why I think to translate it with thought is not really ideal. It's a very movement of the mind. The object that you're watching, the experience that you have at that time is slightly fluctuating. It's not absolutely still, absolutely immovable. It's slight fluctuation experience. And then you experience the rapture and pleasure born of seclusion, the vivekaja pitisukha. And this is another level of happiness again. Now you've entered a new realm. This is specifically called that particular happiness that comes from seclusion of the five senses. This is the first dharma experience. It's kind of a strange way it is described, right? But it is, the nice thing about this is that it is very sparse in words, but a very kind of people who go here to say this is a very accurate kind of very accurate description of what is going on, because it's very, very hard to describe these things because they are so different from our ordinary experience. Then comes kind of the interesting part here, or the really interesting part as well. This is that this is called the footprint of the Buddha, a footprint of the Tathagata. So what that means is that when you come to these jhanas, you're getting almost into the presence of the Buddha. You have this feeling that the Buddha is very far away, the Buddha must have walked here too, because these things are so profound that only you almost have to be a Buddha to walk through these kind of things. A footprint of the Buddha, a very profound description of these jhanas. And one of the things that we find in the sutta, that the way the jhanas are often described, they are described as extraordinarily profound things. Often you hear people say, I can't get the jhanas, I can't get there. No wonder you can't get there, you're almost enlightened when you get there. So you shouldn't be too worried about that. What you should be concerned about is whether you're making progress on the path, whether you're getting a little bit of happiness and joy in your meditation. If you get that, great. Jhanas is like, you know, this is kind of really massive, massive amounts of happiness and joy, and it's kind of way down the path. And it kind of makes this path even more interesting, that it's possible to actually reach these extraordinary states of mind that are here called the footsteps of the Tathagata. In the suttas, you always find that the four stages of awakening, they are always described together with the four jhanas. Yeah? So awakening and jhana are very closely related to each other in the suttas. In fact, the jhanas are called the Sambodha Sukha in the suttas, literally. And Sambodha means awakening. So it means the jhanas are the happiness of awakening. Yeah, so you are, in other words, you are almost there. You're getting so close that basically you are pretty much there already. And then, of course, based on those jhanas, anyway, you reach the awakening experience. You're getting very close to the end of the path at this point. So there's a tendency in the world to underestimate the profundity of the jhanas. This is, I think, a massive problem for the Buddhist world. Because once you underestimate the jhanas, you also underestimate the insights that arise from those jhanas. So everything gets kind of dragged down, becomes more ordinary. These things are extraordinary, lofty things. The only people I trust with this is the people who explain these things in the most profound sense. These are the people I trust as far as the jhanas and this insight are concerned. Precisely for this reason. Okay, let us have a quick look at the other jhanas as well. And with the filling of this initial and initial and sustained application of the mind, the bhikkhu enters upon and abides in the second jhana, which has self or confidence and singleness of mind without the initial and sustained application of mind, with rapture and pleasure born of stillness. This too is called the footprint of the Buddha. But you do not yet come to the final conclusion that the Blessed One is fully awakened, etc. So the second jhana is one where you have absolute stillness. This is why it is called here the rapture and pleasure born of stillness. Yeah? For the first time in your life, your mind is absolutely still. There's no movement at all. Fixated on an object for many hours at a time. No movement whatsoever. You can't move, right? At this point, you have already left behind all will, all doing a long time ago. You can't move. There's no choice there. You're just staying with the object. Staying. Very happily so. And of course, part of the realization that you have at this point is that the doer, the movement, all of that is dukkha. Once you leave that behind, it is far preferable. Self-confidence, this means that the mind has confidence in the object. Self-confidence, not a very good translation. It sounds like something completely different, really. It means you have confidence in the object, and that is why you get the singleness of the mind, and the samadhi arises from that. In all of these cases, it is the footstep of the Tathagata, but you do not yet come to the conclusion that the Buddha is enlightened, right? Because you haven't seen the Buddha fully yet. You've only seen the footstep. So you have to actually see the Buddha fully before you come to that conclusion. Just like seeing the elephant in the simile here. Again, with the fading away as well of rapture, of piti, a bhikkhu, a layperson, abides in equanimity and mindful and fully aware, still feeling pleasure with the body. He enters upon and abides in the third jhana, on account of which the noble ones announce, he has a pleasant abiding who has equanimity and is mindful. Right? It's understated, right? He has a pleasant abiding. Yeah. This is the highest happiness you can attain in samsara. And the Buddha said, now you have a pleasant abiding. Yeah. Everything before that is kind of not really. It doesn't quite cut the ice. Yeah. This is it. There's a couple of important things with this one here. Because this, again, is one of the things that I consider a very misleading translation. It says here that you feel pleasure with the body. Body here, the way it is used here, means a direct experience of something. It doesn't mean the physical body at all, it means an immediate experience of something. So what this means is that you feel an immediate or direct experience of sukha. That's what it means. So what is the point of that? The point of that is that in the second jhana, you have both, still both piti and sukha, yeah? The two factors, piti, both rapture and jhana. So here, you abandon part of that happiness, and the happiness that remains is called sukha. And that's why it's called the direct experience of sukha at this particular point. Yeah, so if there's one happiness after the other, one becoming more refined after the other, and at this point, what you do, you reach the peak of happiness that is available in the, of happy feeling that is available in samsara. There's no happy feeling beyond this, because when you enter the fourth jhana, you go beyond all happy feelings, and you enter equanimity. And this is kind of the astonishing thing, this is kind of so weird about this. When you go from the happiest feeling you can have in samsara, you go to neutral feeling here, guess what is preferable? It is preferable to have the neutral feeling here. It is a higher degree of pleasure to have a neutral feeling than it is to have the highest happy feeling you can have. It sounds like a paradox, but this is kind of the weird thing about this path. It is, the more you leave behind, the more actually is abandoned, the more, the higher degree of the pleasure here. These are the paradoxes that are almost impossible to understand, except for someone who has actually been there and seen these things. So it then says, the way this is explained here, is that with the abandoning of pleasure and pain, and with the previous disappearance of joy and grief, a bhikkhu enters upon and abides in the fourth jhana, which has neither pain nor pleasure, but purity of mindfulness due to equanimity. Each one of these is a higher happiness than the previous one, right? And this too, Brahmin, is called the footprint of the Tathagata. Etc., etc. The noble disciple does not yet come to the conclusion. The Blessed One is fully awakened. So that's it. That is the end of the Noble Eightfold Path. It ends with the fourth jhana, where you have the purity of mindfulness due to equanimity. And if you remember, we were talking before about the seven factors of awakening. And the seven factors of awakening also end with upekkha. And upekkha is not equivalent to the upekkha, the equanimity you see here. In the fourth jhana. And then, when you have done that, three things happen. And the three things that happen is the three te vijja, the three liberated insights that come out of this. So maybe it's worthwhile reading all that. Can we do that, Aya? Have we got time, or do we need to stop for him?
Yeah?
Sure,
we have till 11.
Have 11, okay. So I'll just do this, because this is kind of nice to see the path all the way to the end, right?
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, we have to wait maybe, I don't know how long you have to wait to hear this again next time. So this is what it sounded like. These are the three. We talked about this before, but it's nice to read through it, I think, yes. So when his stilled mind is thus purified, bright, unblemished, rid of imperfection, malleable, wieldy, steady, and attained to imperturbability, he directed to the knowledge of the recollection of past lives. Yeah, so all of these qualities here of the mind are the deeper you go into the samadhi, the more it attains these kind of qualities. The idea of being imperturbable here, I mentioned it before, is very important, because the mind can no longer be moved by anything. It's incredibly powerful. And whatever you see, you're able to take it on board. And also the ideas of being malleable and wieldy, right? Which are the idea that the mind is incredibly willing to do whatever you tell it. So when you say to the mind, go into the past, the mind follows your orders like a well-trained dog, basically. And it goes into the past, and then you jump over from the moment of your first thought, your first memory, and it jumps off into a past life. Remember, your mind is incredibly powerful here, so you can remember things that you thought you had forgotten a long, long time ago. You kind of go back to you were a small child, or even a baby sometimes, and eventually you make that jump from being a baby and then back into a past life. And then you can keep on going like that. And this is what happens. He recollects his many whole past life. One bird, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, 100,000 birds. Many eons of world contraction, many eons of world expansion, many eons of world contraction and expansion. There I was so named, of such a clan, with such an appearance. Such was my nutriment. Such my experience of pleasure and pain. Such my life term. And passing away from there, I reappear elsewhere. And there too, I was so named of such kind, with such an appearance. Such was my nutriment, such my experience of pleasure and pain, such my life firm, and passing away from there, I reappear here. Thus, with the aspect and particular, he recollects his manifold past lives. This true Brahmin is called the footprint of the Tathagata. But the noble disciple does not yet come to the conclusion the Blessed One is fully awakened. Yeah, so this gives you an idea what this recollection of past life is about. You recall all the details, so you have a very clear vision of it, and you recall how you move from one life to the next one, until eventually you reappear here. There's like a causal sequence. You see kind of one thing happening after the other, and you see how it all fits into a pattern. And this is the kind of the thing that distinguishes just random thoughts about the past, random ideas that you may have through past life regression, these kind of things, or just images popping up in your mind in meditation. This is a much more thorough and connected idea of what past lives are about, ending up in this life. Very powerful experience of these things. That is the real kind of, this is the real deal in terms of past life recollection. Then, when his mind when his stilled mind is thus purified, bright, unblemished, rid of imperfection, malleable, will is steady, and attained to imperturbability, he directs it to the knowledge of the passing away and reappearance of beings. With a divine eye which is purified and surpasses the human, he sees beings passing away and reappearing, inferior and superior, fair and ugly, fortunate and unfortunate. He understands how beings pass on according to their actions thus. So this is the understanding of karma, right? How actions affect our moving around in the samsaric cycle of up and down or whatever it is, or going around and around. These worthy beings were ill-conducted in body, speech and mind, revilers of noble ones, wrong in their views, giving effect to wrong view in their actions. On the dissolution of the body after death, they have reappeared in a state of deprivation, in a bad destination, in perdition, even in hell. But these worthy beings who were well conducted in body, speech and mind, not revilers of the noble ones, right in their views, giving effect to right view in their action, on the dissolution of the body after death, have reappeared in a good destination, even in a heavenly world. Thus, with a divine eye which is purified and surpasses the human, he sees beings passing away and reappearing, inferior and superior, fair and ugly, fortunate and unfortunate, and he understands how beings pass on according to their actions. This too, Brahmin, is called the footprint of the Tathagata. But the noble disciple does not yet come to the conclusion the Blessed One is fully awakened. This gives you also an idea of the main qualities that give rise to bad and good rebirth, right? Obviously here, sila is an important one. It's interesting that the idea of revilers of the noble ones is singled out. So the karma that we make in regard to people who have practiced a long way on the path can be very powerful. That's why you have to be a little bit careful when you are around somebody who you feel might be very kind of, arahant or whatever. You have to be a bit careful because you can end up making a lot of bad karma. You can also make a lot of good karma. This is a nice thing. You can make either good karma or bad karma. These are fields of merit that are very powerful in the world. Just like one's parents are also fields of merit that are very powerful, so with the noble ones. In fact, the noble ones and parents are almost kind of looked upon in a little bit of the same way in the suttas. So that is interesting, and wrong views is often pointed out as a source of bad karma, but of course giving effect, it says here, to those wrong views is particularly what kind of really matters the most. So that kind of gives you a nice summary as well of what is important. And then you see how all of these beings run around in samsara, get to be born here, get born there, kind of up and down, round and round. And after a while you think, oh no, enough. It's interesting how these two insights, the idea of past life and also the idea of how karma is the thing that actually drives the past our moving on in samsara, it's interesting how the Buddha always remembers these things before his awakening, right? And this seems to be a standard everywhere you read the suttas. The Buddha recalls these things before his awakening experience. And of course the point is that when you see this, when you see this kind of eternal moving around, going from here, going to there, now experiencing suffering, now experiencing more happiness, always being problematic one way or another, and it just goes on and on and on, fueled by craving, tied down by craving, and blinded by ignorance, as it says in the suttas, you can see how this gives a strong sense of wanting to finish all of this. Yeah, you had enough. You don't want to do this anymore. You see, it's completely pointless after a while. It's very interesting how our lives now, when you see them only one life at a time, it can seem purposeful in a certain sense. Yeah? When you kind of grow up, you think, yeah, I've got to go get myself a good education and I kind of have a nice job and maybe I can do some good with my job at the same time. It kind of feels purposeful. But I think the longer you live, the older you become, the less purpose you can actually see in all of that. You're starting to see that one day you're going to die. And you start to wonder whether it really made all that much of a difference. Yeah, I did all of those things, but so what? How much difference did it actually make? And imagine seeing that, doing that again and again and again, growing up, thinking that life is really important, I've got to do all these things really matter, and then kind of getting older and kind of getting slightly disillusioned by it all. And when you've done that 100 times, 1,000 times, 1,000,000 times, right? You think, enough of this, I don't want to do this anymore. This complete waste of time. I'm just going around and around and around, experiencing the same thing again and again, making the same mistakes in life after life. What is the point of this? It's completely ridiculous, actually. And it's not only ridiculous, it is suffering at the same time. And when you see that, of course, it gives this powerful impetus to get off the wheel of samsara and not be reborn again in the future. And especially if you are the Buddha, if you are the first person, you're going to need a very powerful impetus because the delusion of the self and all of these things are going to stand in the way. You need something very powerful to enable you to be able to see through that. So this is why I think that this is part of this insight that leads to the Buddha's final insight, which comes up now, which is the insight where you actually become a Buddha, you become an arahant. When his stilled mind is thus purified, bright, unblemished, rid of imperfection, malleable, wieldy, steady, and attained to imperturbability, he directs it to the knowledge of the destruction of the ending of the asavas. These are the corruptions of the mind, right? The things that always kind of distort and trouble you. He understands as it actually is. This is dukkha. This is suffering. This is the origin of dukkha. This is the cessation of dukkha. This is the way leading to the cessation of dukkha. And we already talked about this quite a bit of length at the beginning of the retreat, the idea of the Four Noble Truths. These are the asavas. In other words, these are the corruptions. This is the origin of the asavas. This is the ending of the asavas. This is the way leading to the ending of the asavas. These things that tie you down to samsara, they have come to an end as well. This true Brahmin is called the footprint of the Tathagata, something scraped by the Tathagata, something marked by the Tathagata. But the noble disciple still has not yet come to the conclusion. The Blessed One is fully enlightened, etc. Rather, he is in the process of coming to this conclusion. So here, this seems to refer to stream entry. When you first enter the stream, and now you kind of have seen the Dhamma, you don't yet know that the Buddha is fully awakened because you haven't yet attained that same awakening yourself. But you are, as it says, in the process of coming to that conclusion. You are a stream enter. There's no turning back anymore, and soon you will get there. When he knows and sees thus, his mind is liberated from the corruption of sense desire, from the corruption of attachment or craving for existence, and from the corruption of delusion. When he's liberated, there comes the knowledge. It is liberated. He understands birth is ended. The holy life has been lived. What had to be done has been done. There is no more coming to any state of being. Yeah, this is what you know when you become an arahant. This is the insight that you have. You know that you are liberated. This is the first thing here. And apart from that, what you do is that your birth has come to an end. There is no more coming to any state of being. This is the insight that you have when you're an arahant. It doesn't say anything about anything else. That is what it really means. This is what kind of singles out the becoming to the very end of the path. It's all about ending existence. No future rebirth. Nowhere further to go from this. Yeah, so rebirth is absolutely fundamental. The final liberation, the ending of samsara is what it's all about. This is what really matters. This is actually, so when you take out rebirth out of the equation, as some kind of modern Buddhist try to do, you are reducing Buddhism to something completely different. It's no longer Buddhism, it's some other kind of teaching which really teaches something very, very different. The goal gets kind of this, the whole goal of this beautiful teaching, they're kind of taken down to something very mundane and very ordinary here, but actually it is something very lofty and very profound and very kind of expansive. So we have to be very careful. We have to somehow, sometimes put away our modern prejudices and our modern way of looking at the world and being open to maybe someone like the Buddha had an insight into something that is kind of outside of our modern sensibilities, our modern way of looking at things. So that is the Tathagata, the Buddha becoming enlightened or the monk becoming enlightened. And these two Brahmins, it's called the footprint of the Tathagata, something scraped by the Tathagata, something marked by the Tathagata. It is at this point that the noble disciple has come to the conclusion, the Blessed One is fully awakened, the Dhamma is well proclaimed by the Blessed One, the Sangha is practiced in a good way. And at this point, Brahmin, that the simile of the elephant's footprint has been completed in all detail. Now you know that the Buddha was fully awakened because you have seen the very thing that he has been pointing to all along. You know that the Dhamma is effective in giving, in delivering the same thing. And you know that the noble Sangha is practicing the right way because they have seen that same path. And for that reason, they are there. So all of these become direct insights. This is why, when you become arahant, you actually know that the Buddha, as well, must have been awakened as a consequence of that. And then when this was said, the Brahmin Janusoni, he's the one who was listening, said to the Blessed One, "Magnificent Master Gautama, magnificent Master Gautama. Master Gautama has made the Dhamma clear in many ways, as though he were turning upright what had been overthrown, revealing what was hidden, showing the way to one who was lost, or holding up a lamp in the darkness for those with eyesight to see forms. I go to Master Gautama for refuge, and to the Dhamma, and to the Sangha of Bhikkhus." And sometimes the Sangha of Bhikkhus is also mentioned. "From today, let the Master Gautama remember me as a lay follower who has gone to him for refuge for life." There you are. That is the gradual training. And this is what, that's just from hearing about it, you go for refuge for life, and let alone if you actually follow all those instructions and you go there all the way to the end of this life. So that is the end of the gradual training here. And that is the end of this path. And now all you have to do is put into practice, right? Yeah, so now comes the hard part there. So just to remind you very briefly, because you know, it's important to keep things incredibly simple on this path. But if you try to remember all of these sutras, you're going to get kind of completely flooded. You don't know where to start. You don't know what is up and what is down, all of these kind of things. Especially when you come back to your ordinary life, all of these impressions, all of these things tend to lead us astray, lead us away from the path. And we need to be reminded about these things all the time to kind of keep us down the straight and narrow and keep us practicing in the right way. So there's two things, as I mentioned yesterday, which are really the most fundamental things to remember on the Buddhist path. And one of them is a very simple word, that is just to remember kindness. Yeah, if you remember the word kindness, you do that in everything you do, and you always try to keep that in mind, you're never going to go very far wrong on this path. Kindness encompasses everything. It encompasses your speech, your actions, your mental attitudes, how you think. It is such a broad term. And if you bring that into everything you do, then you're going to be practicing really, really well. And you will make good progress on the path just are remembering that one single word. Everything else you may forget, but please forget that one thing. But even that is hard to remember, because in the daily life, you get sidetracked all the time. Yeah, you know what it's like. Even as a monk, sometimes I wonder, what am I doing? I'm kind of doing all kind of stuff, which kind of is completely not really that useful. So the other thing, because even remembering kindness can be harder, the other thing to do is to remember to always get doses of Dhamma all the time, to remember you, to remind you what is the priority in life, what you really should focus on, what really matters. And this is what we're talking about, that beautiful sutta at the beginning, and we were looking at the very start, where it starts off with final liberation, final knowledge, and it brings it back to the core, the basis, the foundation of all that, which is listening, hearing the real Dhamma, meeting the Saparisas, meeting the superior people in the world, and hearing the true Dhamma. So keep on, keep on investigating these teachings, keep on listening to good sutta teachings or good teachings by people you feel have the right attitude. Come back to the teachings of the Buddha to check whether those teachings are correct, and always keep that at the forefront. And if you do, keep on brainwashing yourself in this way. Brainwashing is good. Don't be afraid of brainwashing. If you keep brainwashing yourself in this way, gradually, that whole thing will fall into place. And you will not forget things like kindness. You will not forget all of these basic things on the path that are so important for everything else to take off and work out. That is really the final thing, the Kalyanamitta. Make sure you have the Kalyanamitta around you, and then you will be doing very well there. Okay, so, that's it.
Arahang Sama Sambuddho Bhagava Buddhang Bhagavatang Abhivademi Svakato Bhagavata Gamo Dhammang Namasami Supatipanno Bhagavato Sāvaka Sangho Sanghaṃ